On this episode of Skeptico.
I mean, some of the things that Sacks said I thought were borderline irresponsible. I mean, he said that his claims were not just unscientific. They were more than that. They were anti-scientific. And I think it confuses people because they hear what you're saying, Jan, and you sound reasonable and you sound like you have some kind of authority and some kind of research behind you. And I think people are scratching their heads going, but wait a minute, well, these other people that we respect so much, they seem to have a position too. What's their position?
Well, yeah, my response is actually probably very much like yours would be. My sense is that many professionals who maintain a materialist, reductionist perspective, this idea that everything arises from the brain, probably haven't looked at the NDE research or research in other areas, as I mentioned, after-death communication, reincarnation, and so forth. So it's just a challenge that if people have strongly held beliefs, they tend not to want to look at the evidence in the other camp.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're going to look at near-death experience science, and we have with us Dr. Jan Holden from the University of North Texas. She's been on the show before, and she's joining me today with two colleagues that she's working with from outside the United States that were here for this recent near-death experience conference. And you know, the biggest takeaway from this interview that I had is the continuing state of near-death experience science and how it's largely ignored by the mainstream media. Hey, when was the last time you heard Dr. Jan Holden quoted on a mainstream science paper in response to one of these silly rat brain surge studies that make such big news? So the situation that we've reported on here in the past is pretty much the same. We have these frontline near-death experience researchers who are pushing the ball forward, coming back with rather amazing results that continue to confirm that this is a phenomena that completely defies our medical understanding, completely defies the materialistic, reductionistic mind equals brain model, and yet they're largely, for the most part, ignored. But we talk about all that in this interview, and we also talk about the future of near-death experience science and how that paradigm change we always talk about might come about. And I think Jan has a fantastic answer to that. We also talk in depth about some of the studies that these three researchers have done, including Ali's look at the near-death experience and the Quran, and Tosh from New Zealand looking at the cross-cultural aspects of near-death experience science. It's an interview I think you'll really enjoy if you're into this stuff, and I guess that's why you're here, because you're into this stuff, so I hope you enjoy it. Today we're going to talk about near-death experience research, and we're fortunate to have three very qualified NDE researchers joining us. First, I want to welcome back Dr. Jan Holden from the University of North Texas. Jan is very well known and highly regarded in the near-death experience research community. She is, if you didn't know, the co-author, along with Dr. Bruce Grayson, of The Handbook of Near-Death Experience, which, as the title suggests, is the book when it comes to cataloging and organizing the 30 years or so of research into near-death experience. One of the things we'll be talking about is that I think that probably comes as a surprise to most people. One, that there's 30 years of this research and that there's so much of it that it has to be cataloged, organized, and probably still then trimmed down to fit in such a substantial book as that. Also joining us are two near-death experience researchers who recently presented at the International Association of Near-Death Studies Conference in San Antonio, Natasha Tassel-Matamua, and I think I'm going to be going with Tosh from here on out, is an NDE researcher from New Zealand who is visiting on a Fulbright scholarship, which, how fantastic is that? Tosh has been looking into some of the cross-cultural aspects of NDEs with New Zealanders. Welcome, Tosh. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having having me.
And Jan, I didn't give you a chance to even say welcome, and thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Alex.
And we're also joined by another visiting scholar from Iran, Alanaghi Ghosamanajad, and I'm definitely going to be going with Ali from here on out, is going to tell us about his investigation into near-death experiences inside of the Iranian culture, and hopefully we'll also talk about NDEs and the Quran. So there's a lot, obviously, to talk about, and we usually don't do these interviews with so many people, but I thought it was a great opportunity because when I contacted you, Jan, you said you told me that you had these two other researchers who were joining you, and you guys were kind of collaborating on some work and collaborating on this conference, and I thought, wow, what a great idea to and a great opportunity to give people more of a sense of the breadth of some of the work that's being done out there in near-death experience science. So thanks all to joining me.
Sure.
And first, just real quickly, what was the conference experience like for all of you, for each of you?
Well, I'll start. I loved it, as I always do. It's a unique experience because the audience consists of everything from near-death experiencers themselves to people who research NDEs, people who teach about NDEs. And so it's a very mixed group of people, which really makes it enjoyable. And we had some wonderful keynote speakers. We had Anita Morjani, who is a near-death experiencer who had a profound healing in her near-death experience from she was in the last few hours of her life with lymphoma and had a profound near-death experience and left the hospital a few weeks later cancer-free. And then Eben Alexander returned, the neurosurgeon formerly on the Harvard Medical Faculty who had a near-death experience and it completely revolutionized his views about consciousness and medicine. And then we had the evidential medium, Suzanne Giesman, who was new to the conference, and we invited her back for next year because she was so interesting. And then we had experiencer panels and research reports and theoretical papers and all kinds of things. So it was a very successful conference and the largest attendance at an IONS conference ever. It was over 350 people.
Wow, that's terrific. And we should mention to people that even though this year's conference has passed, it's ended, people can still go to IONS.org. That's IANDS.org. And there's many videos from the conference up already, and I think there's more coming. Is that right?
That's right. Yep.
And Tosh, what was the experience like? We're going to talk a little bit about one of the papers that you presented there on your work and your extensive work with people from New Zealand. How was the conference for you?
The conference was a wonderful opportunity to spend with people who have had near-death experiences, but also researchers like Jan and also Bruce Grayson. People that me as a researcher in New Zealand don't have a lot of access to, other than via, you know, email or Skype. So for me, it was a really wonderful opportunity to connect with some very well established, very experienced researchers, and to make those connections and get ideas for future research. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to be in that sort of environment as well. In New Zealand, near-death experience research is in its infancy, with really only me and some of my students doing research in the area. So we don't have conferences like this available to us in New Zealand or even Australia. So it was really great to be able to come here, have a bunch really of researchers to network with, but also experiences as well, and to hear the experiences firsthand of people who had near-death experiences.
Yeah, that's great. You know, as Jan, Dr. Holden, I'm sorry to be so informal all the time, but I guess that's okay. But I think even in being informal, it kind of gets to part of the problem, you know, is that sometimes near-death experience research is kind of seen as more, I don't know, less formal and less scientific. And one of the things we hope to do today is point out that really when it comes to real research on this incredibly important medical mystery that everyone acknowledges is happening, you're the only game in town. I mean, this is the research, folks. This is the research that's going on. And when we hear people spout off, even if they're more well-known and have more of a media profile, they are almost never addressing any real research into the phenomena with people who've experienced the phenomena or with people who are likely to experience the phenomena if it's a prospective study, like when they study people in cardiac arrest wards who might experience a near-death experience. So I don't want to apologize, but I do want to kind of frame up that, you know, we're going to be on a first-name basis here and talk real informally, but this is the real research into near-death experience that's going on. And as you mentioned, this conference, even though it has attendees who are also experiencers, has some very, very top-notch scholarly academics like people you've mentioned and the people can find on the website. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things you touched on is relative disrespect for near-death research. I have been surprised that, at least at my institution, I haven't run into any disrespect or only one time did I even get anything close to a negative response to my research. So I've been very grateful for that. And Tosh and I have talked a lot about her experience, and maybe I'll let you summarize how you perceive that.
Okay. Thanks, Jan. Mm-hmm. I think my experience has been very similar to Jan's. I don't think as a researcher, and I know you can't see me, but I'm a relatively young researcher, having only completed my PhD 5 years ago. So for me, it was a bit of an unusual thing to engage in this sort of research, at least within the discipline of psychology. We don't really deal that well all the time with unusual phenomena. So it was a bit of a leap of faith for me to go into this area. But I certainly haven't been unsupported in my decision to do that by my university. I think some of my colleagues were a little surprised at first, but they certainly haven't been unsupportive. And I've found that over the past 5 years, as I've done more research projects, and I guess the profile of the research in New Zealand has increased quite a bit, the response has been very positive, certainly from my colleagues, but also the wider public as well. Every now and then, I still get people from the public who feel compelled to email or write in and express their dissatisfaction with this research, or express that they personally don't think it's worth doing. But overall, the response from the public is very positive. And I think there's probably a desire for this sort of research to be done. And now that it is being done, people are quite pleased about that. So publicly, it's in New Zealand, it's definitely been received very well. But also within the discipline of psychology in New Zealand and with my colleagues, it has also been received quite well. And I think I've received a couple of awards recently in relation to the research, and the Fulbright is one of them. And I think that really speaks to the fact that the area, the near-death studies area, is probably seen as quite a crucial area to start engaging with. And as a result, these awards have come as a result of that.
I think you make a great point there, and that's certainly good to hear. I mean, Ollie, do you want to jump in and kind of share your experiences, one, both with the conference in general, but also in terms of what it's like pursuing this kind of research from an Iranian perspective?
Yes. It was first time to attend the conference, IANS conference, okay? And it was really wonderful for me. And the most interesting thing, the reactions, comment, feedback of the audience about my two presentation. I cannot focus any particular presentation. I like them a lot. And another thing that I want to talk about is if I want to talk about the conference and put in a word, I said inspiring. It motivated me to continue my research that I started 2 years ago. And I think it was a wonderful opportunity to continue to my road, my way to do research about Iranian Muslim NDEs. Because after getting familiar with NDEs, I noticed a lack of attention to Muslim NDEs. There were only two or three articles about Muslim NDEs, and about Shia Muslim, there is no one. So I thought that I can fill this gap, and now I am here to talk about my results of my research. And the conference was good. People, audience, people in the United States were really friendly, and until now, okay, they are friendly too. I liked it.
Great. But you just mentioned, Ali, that you see a gap, or you saw a gap in the near-death experience research when it comes to, for example, the Shiite religious people in Iran. What do you think is the nature of that gap in the Muslim community in general in terms of this near-death experience research? Why is it there? How is it there? Is it there?
Because there are only two or three articles that publish about Muslim NDEs, okay, and the participants were not very, the participant only 5 or 10, okay. Mm-hmm. So I started to interview Muslim Shia NDRs, more than 50 maybe, okay, if I can. And I established a website, educate people about Iranian NDRs. Okay, it was first time. It is first time that they hear about NDEs. I think our professors, people, I don't know, researchers in Iran don't know about NDE, unfortunately. And when I wanted to start the research, there wasn't nobody to help me, and I had communication with a professor from the United States or other countries that conducted research about NDEs. And if you look at the articles, books, you can see that there is a lack of attention to Muslim NDEs, especially Shia. There is no article about Shia Muslim NDEs, and majority of Iran are Shia Muslim. More than 80% of people are Shia. So I think it can be helped to investigate, to help us understand about the nature of NDE from different cultures. Okay, there are many articles about other countries, for example, Europe, I don't know, India, and Indonesia, New Zealand, but in Iran, okay, we are not familiar with this subject. And I think, okay, it's just a start to educate people in Iran and help in near-death experiences too, because they are reluctant to share their experience with us. Everybody denies them.
Let's talk about that more later in terms of the cross-cultural part of it, because I think it has some interesting angles to it that kind of cut both ways, as you and I were kind of talking a little bit about in our email correspondence, Jan, before this interview. So let's talk about that later. You know, one of the things I wanted to start with was I was wondering if we could talk about the recent passing of probably the most famous neurologist of our time, Oliver Sacks. And if anyone ever remembers that movie, Awakenings, with Robin Williams and Robert De Niro, about this patient who is experiencing these horrible neurological conditions that then this doctor, Robin Williams, heals him. And that doctor is kind of really the Oliver Sacks figure, and very well-known, beloved by many, figure in the science community, certainly in the neuroscience community and the neurological community. And I wanted to talk about him because, you know, I hear what you all are saying. It's inspiring to go to the conference. And gee, we're making progress. And more people are now open to looking at near-death experience science. And I don't know, guys, where I sit, I just juxtapose that against what mainstream science is saying with their large megaphone out there. What Oliver Sacks was saying before he passed into that next dimension where he's experiencing, we can only imagine, something different now. But the model remains intact for those guys that NDEs are, and this is Oliver Sacks, hallucinations. And they may have some nice language about how those hallucinations are formed and don't feel bad about them, but they're still hallucinations. And I just wonder how much progress we've really made, because science isn't done in a vacuum. It's a social enterprise. It's a cultural enterprise. It shapes culture, and culture shapes it. So, you know, this whole thing of NDE research, to me, I think boils down to the NDE researchers, the people who are doing the science, are on one side, and Oliver Sacks and the neurologist and the neuroscientists are really on the other side, because this is a direct attack, not just on their profession, but ultimately on their livelihood. It so directly contradicts their model that, I don't know, I just think we maybe do ourselves a disservice if we don't understand and share with other people the extent to which the battle lines are really drawn, at least from my perspective. You are telling me you don't see it that way and you see progress being made. So maybe I'm wrong here. So I'd like to hear more about what you guys think about that.
Well, I can jump in. And, you know, I've wondered too what Oliver Sacks would say now that he has actually, you know, moved into, in my way of thinking, another an extension of physical life. But you know, it's kind of hard to get people who stay dead to come back and participate in interviews. So we may never know. But I agree with what you're saying, Alex, that the mainstream scientific perspective is that consciousness is a product of the brain, such that when the brain dies, consciousness dies. And what near-death research, and actually especially in concert with research on other phenomena like after-death communication, nearing death awareness, deathbed visions, reincarnation, and so forth, when there's what cardiologist Pim Van Lommel calls a convergence of evidence, it points to the idea that consciousness exists essentially separate from the brain, but of course extremely closely interrelated with it while we're physically alive. And in my view, well, first of all, I think that, you know, culture changes slowly. And, you know, some famous person said, it changes funeral by funeral. And so it does take time for a paradigm shift in thinking to occur. But you said something that I find really interesting, that neuroscientists and so forth seem threatened by this information. I do understand them feeling threatened in the sense that, you know, we're always threatened when our fundamental beliefs are challenged. But on the other hand, there is no reason for scientists and other, I'm sorry, medical people and neuro people and those people in those kinds of professions to be threatened by the idea that consciousness is essentially independent of the brain, because the brain is, from that perspective, the brain is seen as a source of limitation. It's a filter on what actually is our bigger capability. And that filter is critical. If I've had a stroke, I want a neurosurgeon who knows a whole lot about how the brain works to help me regain as much of my brain function as possible, because I can't access my consciousness while my body is alive. Well, I shouldn't say can't, but my capacity to access my consciousness is very limited, based to a great extent on what my brain is capable of. So there is still absolutely a place for all the science and scientific discoveries and all of that that's needed for managing the brain and maximizing its ability to access the consciousness for which the brain serves as kind of a cell phone. So, you know, it would be like saying, just because you discover that the message coming to you on your cell phone doesn't originate in the cell phone, then cell phone repairs should feel threatened. I don't think so, because I still need the cell phone to get the message.
That's a great point. And I think that message needs to be repeated and amplified so that that group can see that there is a way forward. Not that they're going to jump on that chance, because right now they rule the roost and they are the king, and the king never likes to give up his crown and say, okay, I'll play this other role here, this more minor role. But and I think you did a good job of, I think, laying out that landscape a little bit. One of the things I was trying to draw out is I do find that people are confused by this underlying war that's going on that a lot of times isn't made explicit. And when I say people, I mean I was for a long time myself confused. You know, when Oliver Sacks says that scientifically speaking, these hallucinations are false, or when he, you know, when he really came out strongly, as did all these folks in the neuroscience, neurological model of consciousness, is when Dr. Eben Alexander, who you mentioned earlier and has been on the show a couple times, when he came out with his New York Times bestselling book, Proof of Heaven, they just circled the wagons and attacked viciously. And to the extent that, I mean, some of the things that Sacks said, I thought were borderline irresponsible. I mean, he said that his claims were not just unscientific. They were more than that. They were anti-scientific. I mean, that is some kind of over-the-top ammunition that he's throwing at a guy. And I think it confuses people because they hear what you're saying, Jan, and you sound reasonable and you sound like you have some kind of authority and some kind of research behind you. And I think people are scratching their heads going, but wait a minute, these other people that we respect so much, they seem to have a position too. What's their position? And I guess that would be the question. What is their position vis-a-vis the NDE research? I keep seeing them not responsive to the NDE research. I mean, they're out there saying their thing, saying their spiel, but they never tie it back to the NDE research.
Well, yeah, my response is actually probably very much like yours would be. My sense is that many professionals who maintain a materialist, reductionist perspective, this idea that that everything arises from the brain, probably haven't looked at the NDE research or research in other areas, as I mentioned, after-death communication, reincarnation, and so forth. So it's just a challenge that if people have strongly held beliefs, they tend not to want to look at the evidence in the other camp.
But let me interject there, because I don't think that's always the case. You know, mm-hmm. I just had an interview with a guy named Dr. Evan Thompson from a philosopher from the University of British Columbia, very prominent in the NDE debate circles, always taking the other side, the neurological model, because that's also his background, and well-versed in the near-death experience literature, has written a book kind of directly challenging Dr. Pin Von Lommel. I also interviewed a couple of years ago Yale neurologist Dr. Stephen Novella. Again, this is Yale. This is, you know, supposed to be one of the most highly regarded institutions in the country. I directly addressed with him, you know, how his neurological model doesn't fit the data. Because, again, you know, let's understand each other and understand where these guys are coming from. You know, one of the words and phrases they like to kind of kick around is the neural substrates of emotion. They'll say things like this. They'll say, oh, you know, all these experiences, they're fantastic, they're wonderful, but there's a neurological basis if we really get down to the heart of it. And then when you push him, like I did Novella, and I said, okay, but Steve, you know, look at the research of like Dr. Jeffrey Long. All these hundreds and hundreds of near-death experiencers, 92% are experiencing deceased relatives, and only deceased relatives, no one who's living. Now, you're going to tell me there's some aspect of the brain, some little neuron we can put our finger on that says, oh, you're having this kind of experience, therefore, let's only key up and create these hallucinations with deceased people. I mean, it's a bizarre notion, and yet that's what these people are advancing, but they're not advancing it in a vacuum. They're advancing it in direct response to the research that you guys are generating. So again, maybe I'm pushing this too hard, but I don't think I am. I think the battle lines are drawn a lot deeper than we think and a lot deeper than the near-death experience research community kind of wants to acknowledge. I don't think we can dismiss these people as just, you know, uninformed. They haven't really read the research. No, they're just attacking the research because it's in their interest to do so.
I think what you're saying is accurate, that some people are familiar with the research, yet still disregard some aspects of it. I think there's selective attention to aspects that they feel capable of criticizing. And I have yet to hear a explanation of any kind of veridical perception, you know, how people, numerous cases of people who, based on the condition and position of their physical body, shouldn't have been able to perceive what they report having perceived that is later investigated and found to be accurate. And I just don't know of a way to account for something like that in a hallucination model. I almost have a hard time even giving the hallucination model any credibility, because so many researchers have already clarified the numerous differences between hallucinations and near-death experiences. And so it's hard for me to understand how someone could still hold that position. But I think it's selective. I think to step back, though, the only thing I can think to do is continue to research, continue to look at all the evidence, have faith that, as seems to have happened in the past, when there was the resistance was to new ideology because of a well-established existing ideology, eventually the weight of the evidence shifted, and what was once heresy is now almost thoughtlessly accepted. And, you know, not the most obvious example being, you know, the world is flat. No, the world is round. We just don't question that anymore. But at one time, people were dying for contending that the world was round. So, yes, there's resistance. And it's just the nature of humans to go through this process. At least it has been so far. So my view is just to stay the course and have faith that if, in fact, what we seem to be uncovering and discovering in the field of near-death studies really is supports a paradigm shift, that the shift will happen when the weight of evidence brings it about.
Well said. Just do the work. And I'm just going to touch on one more point on this, and then we'll move on. But, you know, you mentioned the point about hallucinations and how thoroughly that has been refuted by just good, solid, near-death experience research. The other aspect of that that I think is interesting from the cultural science standpoint that maybe you can comment on is I'm always amazed when the neurological folks talk about these topics like they're impenetrable questions, you know, like, gee, no one's ever had an hallucination before. We couldn't possibly study whether memories are hallucinations or whether memories are hallucinations or not. You know, and Tosh, you're from the psychology department, from psychology background. You know, you'd immediately go, well, no, wait a minute. We've studied that a lot. You know, we have a lot of evidence and a lot of ways of determining whether memories are accurate, how they're accurate, how they're formed, and all that stuff. And then when someone goes and does that research and it's ignored, it's kind of the double whammy. It's like, first of all, I think a real scientist, it would behoove them to say, well, gee, there's an interesting research question there, and here is the research question, rather than just say, oh, it's an hallucination. I know that from my experience. And then two, to act like it's a question that can't be answered scientifically, because of course it can. And that's hallucination, so it's a little bit off our topic today, but I think it ties into some of these other topics that we're going to talk about, because those too are scientific questions.
So yeah, I think we agree with what you said, that we not only can these questions be examined scientifically, but they have been, and we're back to people who align with the existing the prevailing view, really looking carefully and open-mindedly at the research that has emerged.
Okay, let's switch over and talk a little bit about this cross-cultural near-death experience research. Tosh, both you and Ali have looked at that in slightly different ways. Can you give us just a brief summary, if you would, of what you set out to do, Tosh, and some of the research questions that you were thinking about when you embarked on this really pretty extensive research project?
So one thing I guess that I noticed when I started getting into the near-death literature was that it was dominated by studies from primarily the US and also Western Europe. I guess I sort of thought, well, this is great. It's wonderful that we have this very strong foundation over 40 years of research by some very, very experienced researchers. But of course, we don't know a lot, and that's one thing that became very apparent. We don't know too much about near-death experiences in non-Western cultures. And New Zealand is, I wouldn't consider it a non-Western culture, but it's not perhaps if we were to have Westernisation on a scale, it's probably not at the extreme end either. And we have quite a diverse ethnic makeup in New Zealand. So I thought New Zealand would be a good place to begin NDE research because we have no studies of NDEs in New Zealand. But also it might feed into, I guess, the dearth of research looking at cultural diversity and near-death experiences.
Okay, so step back for a minute and tell folks why we would even be interested in the cross-cultural aspect of near-death experience, science, studies, however you want to put it. What are some of the high-level questions in terms of why we'd want to look cross-culturally at that?
Well, I think if we look at science in and of itself, it's a cultural phenomenon. It's not the basic tenets of science, the focus on objective, verifiable reality is actually a cultural construct in and of itself. You know, not all cultures believe in objectivity as the main form of knowledge or even a prized form of knowledge. And I can certainly speak to Māori culture, the culture that I'm from. The most prized form of knowledge is that subjective experiential knowledge. So in and of itself, science is a cultural construct. So if we're just looking at NDEs from the, I guess, mainstream westernized scientific perspective, then we're only capturing an aspect of NDEs. We're not capturing the totality of what they potentially are. So I think to ignore culture and any sort of research, whether it's NDE research, whether it's psychology research in general, is a failing because we're not giving people a whole picture, a holistic picture. We're just focusing on an aspect of potential knowledge or what we can know about a particular phenomenon.
Right. And then obviously I think we also want to tease out what part of the experience is culturally based versus kind of physiologically based or somehow other based. You know, I always think of anorexia as being the example, right? So anorexia starts popping up and we say, gee, you know, what's going on? And we can go and study these primarily women, you know, who are, and we can study them genetically and all these other things. Or we can look cross-culturally and then we can say, gee, you know, it seems to be a Western phenomenon. It's only happening in the West. So then that sends us in a different direction. So isn't that another part of why we look cross-culturally, just as is a first level of kind of teasing out whether there's a real phenomena here or whether this is something that somebody watched on TV in the United States and just propagated over and over again. So there's some of that, right?
Yes, yeah, I agree absolutely. I think that's another layer of why we need to do cross-cultural research on NDEs. So certainly we know a lot on Western NDEs, because of the research that has come out of the US and also Western Europe. We don't know whether the same characteristics, the same features, the same after effects of NDEs, whether they're the same in different cultures. So I think it's important, if we're wanting to establish some, I guess, argument for universality, I'm not saying that that's what we should be doing in NDE research, but if we're wanting at least to look at universality as one aspect, then we need to do the cross-cultural research. And that's partly where my research came in. I wanted to know, well, are the features that have been reported on Western cultures like the US, are they the same by people, you know, do people in New Zealand experience these same features? And if so, you know, why might that be? And if not, could it be related to culture? And what I did find, if I can go on and talk a little bit about the findings of the national study, was that, you know, by and large, people who are in New Zealand who have reported near-death experiences appear to report pretty much the same features as people in Western countries in terms of the characteristics of their experiences. So from my perspective, that was a reason for you know, celebrating, I guess, because it does point to some sense of universality about the experience. The only thing I will say is that the terms, or I like to call them linguistic reference points, that people use to explain their experiences can be slightly different. And New Zealand is a rather secular culture. We don't prize religion as much as what I perceive it is prized here in the US. People tended to describe, for example, seeing a being of light as a spiritual being as opposed to Jesus or God. So there are slight linguistic differences in the way people describe the experience. But when we look at the actual characteristics that they're describing, they are very, very similar. New Zealand compared to the US and Western Europe. So I think that's a good thing.
Jan, what do you think about the fact that we're finding near-death experience features and effects being cross-cultural phenomena? What do you make of that in light of what we were talking about earlier in terms of trying to overcome this idea that this is really a brain-based phenomena versus, hey, this is really a paradigm-busting, totally new way of thinking about consciousness? How does this fit into that big question?
Actually, I was watching an online lecture by Gregory Shushin, who's a scholar of ancient texts, and one of the things he talks about is, or that he was lecturing on this particular time, was near-death experiences and their universality across ancient texts of peoples who had absolutely no contact with each other. And he does a really masterful job of bringing all of this evidence, and it's, you know, his conclusion is, his work is easy to follow, his conclusions make absolute sense. And then someone said in the very first question, in the question and answer phase, someone saying, well, couldn't the universality of the experience be attributable to the brain? You know, a brain in 2000, a human brain 2000 years ago probably wasn't that different from a human brain today. And one in New Zealand or Iran probably isn't very different from one in the U.S. And maybe that's what accounts for the universality. And I think the person had a very good point.
Really? I think that's a terrible point, because we have no precedent for how that would possibly work. How on a neurological level, you know, what it gets back to is, again, what you passed to me in email is, you know, Susan Blackmore's explanation of why people see a tunnel. And then they, at least she does a better job of kind of tying it back to some neural correlates that at least we know about and have looked at experimentally. To suggest that the full narrative of the near-death experience and all these features is somehow traceable neurologically, I just don't know where there's a model for that. I don't know where there's a model for that in the dream research, in the hallucination research. I don't know where any kind of model like that exists. I look at it from the first point of what you said about Shoshan, who's been on the show, and said, hey, folks, take a look. We are the first recorded culture in history that has ever postulated that there's nothing after death. We're the first ones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I really wasn't finished, because although I think from a logical point of view that questioner had a very valid point, The problem is that near-death experiencers have reported perception occurring when the brain apparently was completely offline, completely not functioning. And the most recent case came from Sam Parnia, that I think you've had on your show. And in his AWARE study, they had one case with a very clear that the patient was a couple of minutes into cardiac arrest when the cardiologists tell us that, you know, after 20 seconds, there's no more measurable brain activity. And, you know, an EEG is flat, you know, what we call flatlining. And so in our current models of neurological processes, we can't explain how someone who's 2 minutes into the process of having no oxygen to their brain could be having complex, accurate perceptions from a position apart from their physical body. So again, I think that the question of the universality of near-death experiences is important, just to be able to say, the deep structure of NDEs is universal. Maybe the, as Tosh says, the linguistic points are, the linguistic references may be different, but when you dig down to what the person is really referring to, it's the same across cultures. It's an important point to establish or disprove, but if that point is established, it alone will not refute the neurological model. What really refutes the neurological model is cases where accurate perception of unexpected phenomena is occurring at times that the neurological model would say there could not possibly be coherent perception and consciousness.
This is an interesting point. It's a little bit of inside baseball, but it's something that I'm interested in, and I think a portion of my audience is interested in. And that's that it's back to the first point. I think that's where NDE science is maybe taking a wrong turn or letting the other guy kind of dictate the rules of the game, you know, by saying we can't overturn the model with that. We're confining ourselves too much, because the other way I'd characterize the universality issue is that it dramatically increases the burden on the neuroscience crowd to prove or to come up with some model for how that could be. So just because some guy sticks his arm up and says, hey, couldn't it be the brain? No, it behooves you to show how that might happen, where else we have experience of that. You know, it's like the thing that came out a couple of years ago. Many people are aware of this, but at the University of Michigan, they did a series of experiments with rats who were dying, and they were killing the rats. Of course, that's part of the way medical research is done. And they noticed a burst electrical activity after the rats had died. And even though these researchers hadn't surveyed the near-death experience research, even though there's some huge logical problems in making this leap, they nonetheless made the leap and said, hey, we think maybe this has some implications for near-death experience science and what's happening during a near-death experience. And immediately we start playing that game. We start responding to that, even though it's kind of a nonsensical non-starter of an explanation. And I think the same goes, because at the very least, it overthrows all the existing neurological models. So these guys are so quick to get away from and to avoid and to sidestep the near-death experience model that they totally backtrack all the existing neuroscience we know about how the brain works, about how memories are formed, about what, as you alluded to, what your EEG would look like if you're having this profound experience. It would be lit up all over the place. It wouldn't look the way that it did. And I'd say the same applies here with the cross-cultural thing. I mean, if you're really going to advance that Ali does this work with the Iranian Shia, and they have a similar experience, and Tosh reports this from New Zealand, as have so many other researchers across culture. If you're really going to jam that back into a neurological model, buddy, you better have some pretty convincing evidence, because it just doesn't make any sense that that could trace back to some neural correlates, does it? I don't see how that could work.
Well, I'll just jump in here. And in my other incarnation, the thing that I teach at University of New Zealand is cultural psychology. And that's why I'm quite big on the cultural stuff, you know, and the cultural question. But what we do know is that people from different cultures process information differently. So just looking at cognitive processing, we know that people from more individualistic cultures tend to have a more analytical style of processing, whereas people from more collectivistic cultures tend to process more holistically. So when we're looking at the neurological model, we know that the cognitive processing information systems that people have differ according to the culture that they're from. So the fact that we're finding some sort of universality, or appear to be finding some universality, I guess is in many ways a contradiction to what we do know about cognitive processing. So I guess, I mean, it's a starting point for saying, well, there's something more going on than just the underlying neurological basis. Because I guess you would think that if, from what we know, that cognitive processing styles are different cross-culturally. So just based on that evidence, you would think, well, perhaps NDEs should also differ, just given the fact that people, given it's a psychological experience, that people would psychologically process them in different ways from different cultures. And yet, as far as we know, we're not finding that. So I think that's a reason to be encouraged. And also, as Jen was saying, you know, we've got some very seminal case studies, and also the recent study by Sam Parnia, which points to the fact that in the absence of any detectable neurological or physiological activity, people, or at least some people, still appear to have cognitive functioning, but not in the way that we understand it. So I think the combination of studies which are looking at universality across NDEs, and also if we can combine that with these other more physiologically based studies which look at the absence of physiological activity and yet still very profound psychological experiences, I think if we can combine that information, this is a great thing, you know. I think we're starting to create or at least build an argument which refutes the current objective reductionist materialist model that science operates under.
Okay, very good. Okay, let me move on because I'm talking too much and using up too much of your guys' time. Ali, one of the papers you presented at the recent IANS conference was on the elements of near-death experiences in the Quran. As you show in the paper, there's many, many references that either directly or indirectly refer to some of the aspects that we commonly understand as being part of the near-death experience. So do you think that's going to be surprising to Muslims?
Absolutely, yes. No, we are going to publish an article about this in Iran in Persian philosophical journals, and they encourage me to do this. So I think it would be surprising thing for people in Iran, Muslim people in Iran. They would like it, you know, because it I don't know. You know that or not, that the 30% of verses in the Quran talks about death and after death. So it's wonderful for them to compare features of subjective psychological phenomena, NDEs, based on their beliefs. So maybe it can be an empirical evidence consciousness survival after death, because in Iran and in our literature, religious literature, we only have rational reasons to prove afterlife, so there is no empirical evidence. So NDE, I think it is an empirical evidence to life after death. Maybe people look at this phenomena as an evidence of the verses of the Quran, you know, because in the Quran, God talks about the death and after death, just saying about, for example, some events that happen for you after death or during the death, without any examples, without any empirical evidence. So I think, and I believe that NDE can help us to understand better the verses of the Quran about death. It proves it, and the Quran proves it. It's a mutual interaction between NDE and the Quran. Quran proves the NDE, and the NDE proves the verses of the Quran about death and after death.
See, and Jan, I'd love for you to jump in here, because this to me seems problematic in a couple of ways, because as soon as we move towards any kind of religious understanding of near-death experience, we're again confronted with the divide in science. And I'll tell all of you, you know, if you want to go back and hear this in a dramatic fashion, episode 255 of Skeptico, I interviewed this guy named Ian McCormick, his exclusively Christian interpretation of near-death experiences. So he had a near-death experience. He saw Jesus. Now he goes around. He's an evangelical. He talks to hundreds of Christians. He gets hundreds of accounts of near-death experiences, and they're all Christian. And that is his interpretation of it, and that's what he's out there promoting and advancing in his books and all the rest of that. Now, he's welcome to do what he wants, but as we all know, the near-death experience research, and as I pointed out to him, isn't in accord with his understanding of the Christian nature of the near-death experience. So I'm just not sure where we go with this, Ali, when you say that NDEs prove the Quran and the Quran proves the NDEs. I mean, that's going to be problematic for a lot of people. And these lines that we're talking about, these battle lines, are going to be redrawn as soon as we move in that direction. First off, Jan, what are your thoughts about the religiosity of near-death experiences?
Well, I don't know Ian McCormick, is that his name?
Ian McCormick.
Yeah, I don't know his literature. But I do know other people who have interpreted their NDEs from a specific religious perspective. And I think that it's possible to do that. I think that there are aspects of NDEs that, given any religious ideology, NDEs somehow contradict or just don't quite support. But I think what Ali is saying, and I've of course heard his whole presentation, is that he's found a lot of correspondence between NDEs and what the Quran says, and it's not really very different from what Gregory Shushan has done, finding correspondence between NDEs and ancient texts. And the actual theory that some people put forward is that a lot of religious ideology may have grown out of near-death experiences, that near-death experiences may actually have been the basis of religious views. One of the things we know about NDEs is that despite this deep structure that's very similar, it manifests in the specific terminology and concepts of the culture from which the person comes. So, for example, I like to use the analogy of the human face. You know, virtually every face, unless it's very disfigured, reflects a deep pattern, a deep structure. You know, there are eyes and a nose and a mouth in a relative position to each other. Yet, it's hard to find two faces that are alike. And even in groups of people who have similar features, there are unique features. So if in the same way an NDE that occurred in a certain culture is unavoidably going to take on the unique features of that culture, and then if that's the basis of a religion, it's going to grow its own version of things, and in another culture, the same deep structure took on a different cultural expression and then grew its own ideology. And if all you look at is the surface, those ideologies are going to look quite different. If you dig down to some of the roots, they're going to look more similar. And it's one of the theories that's floating out there that NDEs may be at the root of religion, and that's why there is correspondence, maybe not complete and absolute, but a lot of correspondence between NDEs and various religious ideologies. And Tasha's nodding, so, you know.
Right, but at the same time, that's extremely heretical. Let me ask you this, Ali. How is that going to sit with the Muslim community in general? I can't imagine that's going to sit well with any religious community, because it basically says is that the outward manifestation of your religion is yours to have, but it really represents an underlying truth that is beyond your religion. So the primacy of your religion is then gone. There is no religion that will stand for that.
I think it really does depend on religion. I think about Buddhism, and I think Buddhist adherents would probably disagree with that, you know, and the basic premise of Buddhism, or Buddha said, you know, don't take what I say to be true. Go and experience for yourself.
Okay, but let's leave the Buddhists out of it for a minute. Let's talk about the religions that dominate most of our life, you know, Christianity, Islam. I mean, these folks are not going to, and I'm telling you, you know, it doesn't sit well with Ian McCormick when you say there's the universality thing. It doesn't, and I just don't know. I mean, Ali, you tell me, is it going to sit well with the Muslim community that, yeah, you know, this is great, and it proves that the atheist model is wrong, and that there is an afterlife, but the primacy of the Quran is no longer, can no longer be upheld.
Well, you know, Ali and I have actually talked about this in the short time he's been here. He's just been here a week. I think, like 9 days. But we've already talked about how Ali really believes that NDEs provide an opportunity for people of different perspectives around the world to unite, that if there is some deep universality, it could facilitate world peace. However, we also acknowledge that different people are at different places and even wanting that to occur. And if we look at the fundamentalist strain of any religion, whether it's Muslim, Christian, or whatever, maybe Buddhism is an exception. I don't know if there is such a thing as a fundamentalist Buddhist, but the fundamentalists, you know, they're literalists with their religious texts, and they believe in outward authority rather than inward authority, and they believe that my view is right and other views are wrong. So they're not going to be, you know, inclined toward this kind of thinking. But there also are Gnostic and the mystical tradition of every religion. And I think more likely people aligned with the mystical tradition are going to be more sympathetic or interested in this idea that there is, that we're all connected and that the seeming division between us is at a deeper level of reality, an illusion, and establishing the universality of NDEs could contribute to that for people who are of a mind to be open to that.
Great. I'll tell you what, in the time we have left, I'm going to push you right up to your 2:30 here, Jan. But Jan, tell us a little bit about this other paper that you sent me, Disclosing Near-Death Experiences to Professional Healthcare Providers and Non-Professionals. Very interesting topic. I know it's one of your primary interests has always been the dissemination of this research to frontline healthcare providers, nurses, doctors, the rest. I think that's, for anyone who's looked into that, that's a vitally important thing to pursue. Tell us what you sought to do with this paper and what you discovered.
For this study, we invited near-death experiencers to tell us about their experiences disclosing their NDEs to healthcare providers, and to let us know, was the healthcare provider a medical person like a nurse or physician? Were they a mental health provider like a psychologist or counselor, social worker? Or was it a spiritual slash religious healthcare provider like a minister, chaplain, something like that? And to tell us about the quality of the disclosure experience. Now, the background to this is that we've been learning that, first of all, people who have NDEs also have after effects, that generally speaking, the deeper the NDE, the more features and the more intense the features of the NDE, the more intense the after effects. And sometimes people's lives are very disrupted by the extent to which they've been transformed by the experience. And one of the things that seems to be emerging as a factor in how well people are able to, and how smoothly people are able to integrate these sometimes very disruptive experiences into their lives is their experiences of disclosure to other people. And some indication that, especially if the person has either a good or bad experience of disclosure the first time, it sort of sets them on a path or a trajectory of either continuing to talk about the NDE and being more easily able to integrate it versus stopping talking about it and getting kind of stuck and having more difficulty in the aftermath of the experience.
So, Jan, just so people understand, I have a heart attack. I'm in the cardiac arrest ward. I'm recovering, and a nurse comes in, and I say, "Oh my gosh, can I tell you something that happened to me?" And I tell my near-death experience account. That's kind of what we're talking about here. That's one example of.
Right. And actually, it's a good example because research suggests that, including our own, that medical professionals are who people disclose to the most and who they disclose to earlier on. And so medical professionals in particular seem to be in a pivotal position to either do good or harm to people who've had near-death experiences by the way that they respond when the near-death experiencer tells their experience. So what we had, we ended up with 88 near-death experiencers who reported on 188 of their most noteworthy experiences of disclosure. And we asked them, you know, of all the people you've told about your NDE, and specifically professionals of some kind, tell us about your most noteworthy experiences of disclosure, noteworthy for whatever reason. So we weren't trying to bias them. Tell us about good experiences or bad experiences or whatever. And what we found was that overall, people had somewhat more positive than negative experiences. We found that there were horrible and wonderful experiences attributed to every healthcare provider group. So in other words, some NDEers confided in medical professionals. In some cases, they had wonderful experiences where, and we learned that what made the experience wonderful was, first of all, the health professional recognized the experience as a near-death experience and said, well, you know, it sounds like you might have had this thing that's called a near-death experience. The healthcare provider also responded with acknowledging that either that the experience that the NDEer had was real, because NDEers by and large say that the experience was absolutely real or even hyper-real. And so their confidant responded by saying, you know, that it sounds like it was real, or that it very well could have been real. So you don't have to believe that it's real. You just have to be open to the possibility that maybe it really was. Then the confidant did not diagnose the person or pathologize them as having a mental disorder, which, you know, there's all the research indicates that near-death experiences are equal opportunity, that most of them, just like most of the population is mentally healthy, most near-death experiences happen to people who are mentally healthy. They also happen to people who have mental disorders, but in disclosing the NDE, the healthcare professional didn't jump to the conclusion that the experience or the person was somehow an indication of mental disorder. And then the last feature was that they also didn't jump to the conclusion that the experience was somehow evil or of the devil. And again, research indicates that people in the aftermath of an NDE actually move in the direction of what by any spiritual or religious system would be considered more spiritual. People become less materialistic, more compassionate, concerned about others, and have a greater sense of spirituality in their life, an ongoing sense of connectedness to something greater than themselves. So anyway, both the medical people who confided in a medical professional had wonderful and horrible experiences. People who confided in mental health professionals had wonderful and horrible experiences. And people who confided in spiritual religious health professionals had wonderful and horrible experiences. We found that the earlier a person discloses their experience, the more negative their the experience of disclosure tends to be.
Why is that?
Yeah, well, we have to speculate because we really didn't ask our participants. It's a, you know, follow-up study. But we suspect that it has to do with that early on, people are very emotionally moved by their experiences. And if you combine this with another thing, we found that the deeper the near-death experience, the more negative. So imagine, as you in the scenario you created, you've had this heart attack, you know, you regain consciousness and you blurt out to the nurse, you know, I was in a different place. And the nurse says, well, you know, tell me more about that. And you start to say, you know, first of all, I was out of my body and I saw all this stuff going on in the resuscitation. Then I moved rapidly through this tunnel-like sort of space toward a light. The light was a being. I went into the light. I had a life review. I saw my dead grandmother. You know, you can just imagine somebody who doesn't know about these things, with every word the NDEer is saying, the person's like backing up more and more and thinking, oh boy, this person is really nuts. And early on, people are a little bit more overwhelmed emotionally because these experiences are profoundly emotional. And people, you know, they tear up, they cry, and health professionals who don't realize the profoundness of these experiences could mistake that for, you know, emotional instability. So those were the kind of findings we had, that, you know, there was good news that on average, people's most noteworthy experiences tended to be more positive than negative. But the bad news is that really horrible experiences happened in every healthcare professional group, which points to the need for healthcare professionals to be educated about this phenomenon so that they don't do harm. You know, and every healthcare profession has the ethical imperative to do no harm, but we are doing harm when we respond inappropriately to these experiences. And it's especially, I guess, I feel tragic because these experiences really do have the potential to propel people forward in their psycho-spiritual development, and for that potential to be blocked because of an ignorantly based response to what they experienced just seems really tragic to me.
What are one or two of the most important things you feel like you could tell a healthcare professional about how to handle this situation, particularly if they're not convinced of the reality of this, or they're somewhat aware of the near-death experience research, but it just doesn't fit in with their belief system? What advice would you give them for how to approach this in a do-no-harm kind of basis?
Well, I guess I'll just kind of reiterate the points I made before. The things that seem to make for a helpful response are to know and name the experience. Really say to the experiencer, it sounds like you may have had a near-death experience, and give the experience a name, because as well-known as NDEs are, a lot of people aren't aware of them, or they think that there, and not all NDEs involve a tunnel, moving through a tunnel toward a light. Actually, only about 20% do. And they might not realize that what they experienced was an NDE.
So even if I think it's a hallucination of your mind, I can still at least acknowledge that this is a medically recognized phenomena that we call near-death experience, and I can name it, and that's going to help that patient. So that's number one, right?
Right. That's going to be a help. Then another thing is that whether or not you personally believe that the experience is real, most near-death experiences are adamant that the experience was real. You know, unlike dreams and hallucinations, when people return to normal consciousness after those experiences, they look back on the experience and say, as real as it felt at the time, I now know that it wasn't real. In near-death experiences, people look back on the NDE and they still say, absolutely, that was real. And so just accepting that it is phenomenologically real to the NDEer, and also if they want to be open to research, that research points to accurate perceptions when the person was completely incapacitated, that really do point to the potential reality of the experience. And then don't diagnose the person, because there's no basis for that, on the basis of the NDE alone, that is. You know, of course, some people with mental disorders have NDEs, but you're looking at other features of their thoughts and behavior to render a diagnosis. An NDE alone is not a supportable basis for rendering a psychological diagnosis of mental disorder. And then also knowing that the experience can be, and acknowledging that the experience actually has the potential to be spiritually helpful to a person, rather than being concerned that it somehow is inherently evil, or, you know, of the devil, or something like that. And then I would say the last thing. There might be a few other things that would be good to do, but the last thing is to be able to point a near-death experiencer to resources, because a lot of times after an NDE, a person becomes consumed with the desire to read about spiritual phenomena, and maybe NDEs in particular. They often find it really helpful to talk with other people who've had the experience, because it is an experience of an alternate reality for which Western culture in particular does not prepare people. And so it can really help them to talk with others. And so pointing people to like the International Association for Near-Death Studies website. There's an organization called the American Center for the Integration of Spiritually Transformative Experiences. It's a real mouthful, but they have a website, aciste.org. And IANS, that international association, has local groups that meet around the country and actually around the world, where near-death experiencers can connect with other experiencers and people knowledgeable about NDEs that can be, you know, really helpful to them. So pointing people toward those resources, just saying to someone, you know, a nurse might not have very long to talk with a patient, but to say that, you know, well, tell me about your experience, and then listening openly and not imposing meaning on it, but really helping the person to begin to process what the experience means to them, and then saying something like, you know, as you reflect on this experience over the next days and weeks, if you would like to talk more about it, you can contact me, or if you want to learn about resources, you know, contact me and I'll point you to some things that you might find helpful.
Great. Ali, I'm sorry to have cut you off.
I forgot to talk about the public's reaction to my website, to my research. Okay,
yes.
As I mentioned, an article, okay, I established a website, yerandi.org, in Persian language. Until now, I didn't get any negative comments about NDEs, about my research, and the comments include something like inspiring, wonderful, interesting, keep going, we need more information, more and more. It's amazing for me that I didn't get any negative comments about my research. Dr. Holden talked about it. Okay, in everywhere there are some fundamentalists, conservatives, that they resist the new science, the new results. Okay, so but the public in Iran are enthusiastic about the NDEs and hearing about it. And it encouraged me, it motivates me to keep going about my research.
Yeah, that's great. That's good to know. That's encouraging.
Yes, because everyone asked me, okay, and how was the public reaction? Okay, are you safe? Are you okay if you want to come back to Iran? I say yes, everyone likes it.
Yeah, and I hear you, and I don't want to overstate the case, and I certainly don't know about Iranian culture. I don't know about Muslim culture. That's not my tradition. But I do know that, because I've experienced it more with Christians, and some very nice, intelligent Christians who will embrace near-death experience right up to the brink, you know, right up until you start talking about, well, you know, this does imply reincarnation, and that isn't in the Bible. This does blow away the Holy Trinity. That's in the Bible. It does kind of directly conflict with your doctrine. These are the conversations I've had with people. And then there's like a lot of backpedaling. They're like, oh, no. I like the near-death experience, meeting God, meeting Jesus, but don't hit me with too many of the facts that lie right beneath that. So I don't know if you haven't experienced that, that's great, you know, but I just don't know how a religious person holds on to their religion in light of this data. Unless maybe, like Tosh was saying, maybe you're Buddhist and, you know, it's just like all's good, it all kind of fits together kind of thing. And anything else, guys, from our talk that you would like to add or would like to get in there?
And another thing that I want to mention, that I want to point at, some researchers say that the universality of NDEs may prove that we all have the same brain. And as I, Dr. Holm talked about it, okay, during NDE, brain is off.
Right.
Yes. So it can do anything. And even if brain is on, okay, what is brain? Brain includes our thoughts, background history, beliefs, religion beliefs, I don't know, culture. So if brain is on, the near-death experience would be different from each other because everyone has their own special beliefs.
You're right. It's hard to pack that back in to what we're it's hard to take what we're finding and fit that back into a neurological model. I totally agree with you. And you're right to point out, and I'm glad you did, that we are always talking about a situation where the brain is severely, at the very least, severely compromised. If we don't want to say that it's off or on completely, it's severely compromised beyond the point that we can account for any kind of these experiences. So it's really just a silliness, but we have to keep kind of covering the same ground because that's what's going on.
Yes. And I see NDE as a wonderful opportunity to unite people from different cultures. It's something like the last resort of God to make united people around the world from different cultures, different religions. Unfortunately, politics and politicians, okay, don't like us together to make united with each other, but maybe NDE can do this and unite all of us together.
That's awesome. I love that. The last ditch effort of God. I don't know that God ever needs any last ditch efforts, but I get your point. I think it's a good one.
Okay.
Anything, Tosh, anything you'd like to add before we wrap it up?
No. I mean, unless there's anything more specific you want to ask us, but I think Jan is very articulate at responding to these questions, and you've asked some great things. But is there anything more that you'd like to discuss with us?
No. You guys have been great, and I know I kind of pushed you and maybe seemed a little bit adversarial, but, you know, I do like to not just have these pushover questions that everyone else has asked. We've got to kind of come at this with a little bit of a point of view. At least that's what I find interesting. So that's what I kind of put out there. I thank you both very much for joining me. It's been great getting to know you. And I certainly support your work and wish you the best of luck with it. Please keep me posted in terms of, you know, what you come up with and what's going on with you so I can spread that information out there.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's been great, and it's certainly okay to come across as a little bit adversarial, as you put it, because I mean, in many ways, I guess me at least, and possibly Jan as well, are used to maybe navigating the choppy waters, and I think some of the points you made are really valid. You know, we are up against a beast. You know, the beast of science that is sort of encouraging us to prove something, even though the ideology of science suggests that it's, you know, we can't prove it because it's not possible. So it's important that we are able to get a chance to respond, you know, to the types of statements that you're making, because it's what's needed, really.
Yeah, great. Yeah, and I do also get the sense that it confuses people when we don't acknowledge that's what they're experiencing. Cause I mean, that's what I experience. I think that's what everybody does. When, you know, you go into this and you go, well, wait a minute. How can that be? You know, I mean, this, Oliver Sacks, I mean, he's a, he's the authority. I mean, if he doesn't agree with it, what's really going on? I think you have to break that down for people. Otherwise, it just all glosses over. And it's like, oh, there's two opinions, you know, so what? Let me move on to the next debate. And really breaking it down and going, no, what's really going on here is that these people have an agenda, and it's tied to their livelihood. It's tied to their past beliefs on everything they've been trained, and that's how you have to look at this. Otherwise, yeah, why would Oliver Sacks wouldn't lie, would he? No, he's not lying. He's just caught up in his crap like all of us are.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think certainly, at least in psychology, when the discipline and individuals have spent their entire career sort of doing research that confirms a particular hypothesis or a particular theory, it's very hard when someone comes along and challenges that.
Right.
It's hard. The things that we hold on to the most are the things that we fear to lose in many ways, you know. So, it can be quite hard when NDE researchers come along, and we're challenging the main paradigm. At least in psychology, my research challenges the basic principles of psychology, and that can be very uneasy for a lot of people. You know, they feel uneasy by it. But, you know, as I was saying before, I never said that I was supported in my research. I just said I wasn't unsupported, and I really mean that. there's no open opposition to my research, but there's not really any sort of great open support for it either. It's just not opposition.
I'm sure there's a lot of people in the background cheering you on, but they don't want to step out there too far because they know that's a dangerous position to take. You know, the pioneers, as there's an expression in the United States, you know, the pioneers, like the people who settled the country, you could tell them because they had the arrows not just in the front, but in the back too, you know? So it's like you get it from both sides when you're out there trying to cover the new ground. The people you think are your allies aren't always your allies either.
No, that's right. That's right. That's right. But as Jan was saying, you know, for me personally, maybe for Ali and obviously for Jan, it's just, you know, stay the course. I believe NDEs are really paradigm-changing phenomena, and if we investigate them more, of course they're going to challenge a lot of the basic premises of science, of psychology. But I think psychology also, you know, needs to understand that NDEs can really help us advance a lot of our understandings about basic psychological processes. I think about the life views that people have when they, some people have when they have NDEs, and they say, you know, I remembered things from when I was very young, and then they go and speak to a relative or their parent who verifies the things that they remembered. And, you know, in psychology, we have models of memory which are very limited. They say, you know, in a very general sense, we have a short-term memory, we have a long-term memory, but to try and remember, you know, all the occurrences of our life is impossible. And yet people who have NDEs are able to do that. So maybe the NDEs are pointing to some, you know, or pointing to the fact that maybe we need to revise our models of memory in psychology because they just don't hold up when we look at people who have had near-death experiences. Mm-hmm. Same with the whole consciousness debate, you know. In psychology, we still don't understand consciousness. And you've probably heard of the hard problem of consciousness. We don't know how to describe or explain subjective experience. And just because there's some relationship with a particular area of the brain or a particular neurotransmitter in the brain, it doesn't mean that brain area or that neurotransmitter is manufacturing a particular psychological experience. It just means that there's a relationship. And I think it's a similar thing with near-death experiences, even though there's a proposition that, oh, maybe it's related to this particular brain function or this area or this neurochemical. I mean, there could be a relationship, of course, but it doesn't mean that those things manufacture the NDE. And I think that's something really important that we need to perhaps get out there a little bit more, that correlation doesn't equate to causality. And yet I think a lot of the reductionists, you know, that's probably one of the basic premises of their arguments is that, well, there's a correlation between the, you know, NDE or hallucinations and this particular brain function, but we can't say that it's causality.
And as you know, the old beliefs like materialism don't vanish easily. They resist. They fight. But we are also ready for wars between us and the materialists.
We have to be. That's the way. Unfortunately, that's the way that it is.
Yeah.
Well, it was absolutely great talking to you all, and I do appreciate it. And I will. I'll send you, since I have your email address, I'll send you a link when the show and the posts are up, and I hope you can get some use out of them.
Great. That'll be great. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks again to Jan, Tosh, and Ollie for joining me today on Skeptico. One question that I tee up from this interview, and we didn't talk about it directly in the show, but I'd like to hear your thoughts about it, is how do the mainstream science types, the neuroscience types, continue to dodge near-death experience science? Why isn't any of this science ever referenced? I called out Sam Harris on this, you know, about a year ago when we had this big Eben Alexander fiasco was blowing up. It's like, go look on his website and search for any reference to any near-death experience science. It doesn't exist. These guys just completely ignore the research. How can they do that? How can they call themselves scientists and do that? I don't get that. So what are your thoughts on that? Of course, the place to get back to me and let me know is through the Skeptico website, either in the comments section or jumping over to the forum, or connect with me on Facebook or just send me an email. The Skeptico website is Skeptiko. Don't forget the K-O on the end. Once you're there, you can go back and look at our catalog. We're coming up on 300 shows. Most all of them are available on the website there for download. And we're starting to add some other content to the website as well. That's coming along slowly, but I think we'll have more and more as time goes on. So that's going to do it for this episode. I do have some good shows coming up. Please stay with me for all of that. Thank you so much for the supportive emails that come in. It's so fabulous to hear about people whose lives have been changed a little bit or inspired by the show. You know from hearing me that my life has been significantly transformed by doing these interviews and interacting with you. So it's always great to hear other people who are having a similar experience. I'd love to hear about that if that's your experience. So do let me know. Other than that, until next time, take care and bye for now.